with the book Wealth and Poverty. Each time it's like wading through a massive sea of seaweed. But we're going to try and see if we can at least lay out in brief summary form what is supply-side economics. Please wish me luck. Thank you, Charlie! George Gilder is probably the one person that people recognize as have written the definitive work about supply-side economics. It goes back in history a lot farther than that. There is Say's theory of economics, S-A-Y, and it's very similar to that, and it's a much older theory. It's one that Keynes tried to debunk. But various parts of supply-side economics are Keynesian or Keynesian, part of it Sayian. It's a lot of different things pulled together. But essentially it revolves around when demand replaces supply in priority, then we have a sluggish economy. When demand replaces supply, then we have a sluggish economy. So that Gilder and supply-side economics says that supply is the primary priority as opposed to demand. That as long as supply is up, then we have a good, well-working, functioning economy. Within that structure, government does have a role. The government's role in the economy is to maintain suitable levels of demand by fiscal and monetary policies, so that once a supply is there, they are also to monitor the money supply through the selling of government bonds to the Federal Reserve System and the keeping of the money supply at an equitable level. So if we want to have a short, succinct definition of Say's law and supply-side economics, supply creates its own demand. Without a flow of new products, we have a stale items and stale economies. Supply side means not just continuing to build those things which we have built in the past, but it means to be new and creative. Well, how do you get to this new and creative format? Well, the one item that all of us have some control over is individual time. Our individual time is converted to any purpose as opportunity arises. It's a liquid asset that we all have. So your time, your individual time, 30 hours a week, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, 60 hours a week is your liquid asset for which you then can take and do what you will with it. And we have several options. We can sleep. We can have leisure time and spend 3-4 weeks at Holden Village. Or we can put it into productive time. And when we work, as in production, then we get the fruits of our productive labors. Now, if we limit our productive labors to 30 hours a week, it's supply-side theory that we have liquid assets that we are converting to leisure time. Leisure time is not profitable. Work time is profitable. If we have all this work time, then what do we do with it? Well, we go to work and expend our energies, use our ideas, and in the end product, then we will receive a proportionate share for our productive work in terms of dollars. And those dollars ought to be used for our needs, food, shelter, clothing, and those things which go beyond that. And the hope is that there is something left over beyond that even, that we call savings. And we are to take that savings and do what with it? Invest it. Not put it in a bank, because that is not the same as investing. Saving and investing are two different items. Investing means risk. Investing means putting it out so that we are not necessarily guaranteed a return. it's in line with what we were talking about last night as the early part of the whole familial and community system, where you give away some of your wealth to those who do not have it. Or you give it away to those who have ideas that you don't have, but you think are good ideas that ought to be explored. And that's the unique difference between investment and savings. Savings, as we know them, are essentially guaranteed. They're guaranteed either by banks, by the federal government, in some way in which the return for us is a guaranteed return. Investing can give us a return as well, and we also just might lose it. Yeah, Chuck.
The investor stimulates the demand, the supply and demand cycle. The savior could well resist that cycle. So
say that again.
The investor stimulates the supply and demand cycle. The saver can resist the supply and demand.
That's precisely it.
But what we say, so we say that the bank is invested.
But banks are very careful. As much as we like to say banks make loans, every time a bank makes a loan, they also ask for collateral. So they essentially do not loan money, in most cases, to people who are doing creative things on the new end of the supply side. So in other words, if I've got a brand new idea, the only thing that I probably have collateral for is my house and my car. The bank is not going to buy my new idea. They will buy old ideas, they will buy refurbished ideas, they will buy other kinds of ideas, as long as somebody has the money to back up, or at least the assets to back up what they're asking for. I'm getting in deep, folks. By altering the pattern of reward to favor work over leisure, investment over consumption, the sources of production over the sumps of wealth, taxable or untaxable activity, government can directly and powerfully foster expansion of real demand and income. This is a supply-side mandate. In other words, it's to change how we go about using the products of our productivity. If we are entirely consumers, that too does not help the supply-side economics. If we invest all of our productive worth in items, usually they're items that are already tested. So while we keep the supply-demand cycle working, we don't keep the whole end of new supply working. So while the fruits of our labors is in terms of money, after we maintain our food, our clothing, and our shelter, we do consume some things beyond that. But then it's not only putting some money in savings, but also putting some money in investments. The supply-side movement focuses on processes of production and innovation, a dynamic supply of new goods, rather than regulating control of the money supply or generates a demand for money through production of goods. Let me see if I can break it down a little bit. Last night I used the image of Henry Ford, an entrepreneur who had an idea. He created something for which there was no demand. But by producing that item, then he also then created a demand. And that's a part of that dynamic supply of new goods. If we look at, say, 20th Century Fox, in one season they had three movies that they were trying to, they knew there were going to be box office smashes. One was Dr. Doolittle with a British actor, Rex Harrison, Star with Julie Andrews, and Hello, Dolly with Barbra Streisand. All of them did not become box office winners as the company had expected. But they did make some money off Planet of the Apes. They got lucky because they were willing, and they were some real questions about whether or not to fund Planet of the Apes. It was in production, out of production, because they weren't sure they wanted to invest the money in it. But that new venture then became the way in which 20th Century Fox got themselves out of the doldrums and out of financial disaster. It was not out of their three, quote-unquote, minted box office winners. They were willing to take a risk on something brand new. And then they cleaned up on Return of the Planet of the Apes. The same thing when Rocky was produced. Unknown star, unknown director, unknown story, not going to make it. And now we're watching Rocky III. I guess if you give Sylvester Stallone enough time, he'll really do one well. But it took someone to make that first effort to invest their money into it so that he could produce that film. And that's what supply side is all about. It's new venture capital into new ventures. One of the things that we have a problem with is our money supply. It is regulated. It goes up and down. The biggest regulator of that money supply is the federal government. And it revolves around governmental debt. Whether or not we have money to pay the interest rates that we're giving on bonds and other kinds of loans the government has taken out. That fluctuates with the money supply. If the government's in debt, the easiest way out of it is to print some more money. Supply side's image is to control the flow of the money supply so that it remains stable. I would probably suggest that some of the people who back supply side, like Jack Kemp of the Kemp-Roth bill, would like to see us go back to a gold standard so that we know that a dollar is worth a dollar, whatever that means in today's language. One of the problems that supply side has to deal with is the fact of taxation. Obviously, one of the things that we all enjoyed, I hope, I think I saw it, was my tax deduction. The rates of taxes were reduced by the current administration. Supply side feels that taxes have to be consistently and regularly reduced. Not so much just to give us more money to put in savings accounts because it doesn't get back into the marketplace, but to give us money for investment. It also is recognizing the fact that inflation is an additional tax. No matter how we cut it, it taxes us. Whether it's in governmental debt, whether it's the increased cost of goods, we end up paying. Somehow it is a tax on us. High taxes, then, in terms of supply side, are a brake on production. The tax brake, that's BRAKE, causes inflation by reducing the supply of goods without limiting the supply of money. So when we have higher taxes, we have more dollars chasing fewer items, and so then the cost of those items goes up. In an inflationary cycle, one of the things that we see in other countries and that we're experiencing now is that people invest in high-cost merchandise. They become consumers of things that are truly expensive. We have seen 1,600 auto dealers go out of business, but your Cadillac dealers have an overflow business going in and out of their doors. In Britain, they say right now there are more new Rolls Royces being sold than in its entire history. Because with the cost of inflation, it's easier to buy an expensive item with today's dollars because you don't know how much the item is going to cost tomorrow. So high cost, high taxes, high inflation put a brake on production. So there are fewer items out there, and if there's fewer items, that means that supply is small and the demand is high, the cost goes up. So we have to look at government. Government increasingly, like labor, land, and capital, is a factor in production. It is compensated not by rents, wages, interest, or profits, but by taxes. Government costs, whatever they are, by and large, are passed on to us through higher prices. whether it's government regulation, which means that companies have to spend more research and development time or more testing time, whether it's the taxes that go both to the manufacturer, to the jobber, to the wholesaler, to the retailer, to us, by and large, those costs are not absorbed, but they are passed on to us. So increasingly, the government, whether it's through taxation or regulation, becomes a factor in the production of goods and services. With government being a part of that system of land, labor, and capital, then the one thing supply side feels they must do is make government productivity higher. It needs to be increased. Now, productivity doesn't mean more government. Productivity means lower unit cost. And they feel, in terms of the government, the problem with government management is that it does not set hard-nosed guidelines for those who work in that system. It does not look at unit cost. It looks at what its job is to do in terms of the law. So that if a law is being examined in terms of how a corporation runs a product or how a product is being tested, government does not look for the most efficient way to do that testing or that regulation, but it sees how the regulation must be fulfilled in terms of the law, and then it pours in money and people to do that. So instead of having the same kind of management style businesses and corporations use in terms of unit cost, so they can figure out exactly how much this book costs to put off the line, the government doesn't operate off the same management model. The irony in this whole picture is the government is made up of politicians. Some are civil servants, some are elected, and especially the elected ones are prime entrepreneurs. They necessarily don't realize it in the same kind of way. But the rewards for being in an elective office are the same kinds of rewards that an entrepreneur receives. One is fame. If you succeed as an entrepreneur, you know you've got it made. People come to you with ideas after that. Prime example in this country is the Polaroid Company. Edwin Land had an idea about an instant photo that Kodak wasn't even about to chase. He became a major competitor of the Kodak Company because of that. He had an idea for which there was no demand, but he created the supply of cameras and people chased that supply. In the same kind of way, the people who have investments and or money and or the access to investments are political candidates. They know how to go out and get investment capital in what? Their campaign. Or they have their own personal wealth to invest in their campaign. But for the most part, they somehow make laws then which defeat people who are trying to do what they're doing in the political realm. They make restrictive laws for those who are trying to do it in the private realm, in the public sector. As with politicians, we are not unlike politicians. We underestimate our own creativity and our own abilities, and sometimes our own dumb luck. There's a story of Shockley, who discovered the use of the transistor. Made him famous, made him extremely wealthy. But at the same time, when people were approaching him about the idea of the semiconductor, he could not understand it, could not buy into it, would not invest in it. And in the process, he has made some other people very famous and very rich, because they then bought into a new idea called the semiconductor, which is why most of us can now wear a watch that beeps, tells us what to do and when to do it. Economics and technological breakthroughs always seem impossible in the calculus of a closed rationality, which may then say something about the science of economics. It's not a rational science, folks. Because what happens when they come up to that impossible thing which says it cannot be done? Economics firmly believes in anything science, scientific, or technological, that there will then be a breakthrough. That is a basic premise of economics. And it doesn't matter whose it is. But in supply side, it's extremely important. Because at that point when people say, well, we ought not invest in certain pesticides because we don't know what they're going to do to the environment. Supply side says, in terms of the new pesticides which are now based upon biodegradable substances which are alive, even though we don't know quite how long they live in the environment or whether they live long enough to do the job on certain insects based upon the love or the mating smell of insects. The EPA is holding all of that up because their regulation system is designed for chemical responses, not biological responses. But the entrepreneurs in that area are saying we need less regulation so that we can go through with what we think is a technological breakthrough. And if there are consequences to be dealt with further down the line, we will have the technology to find out what that is and to help solve the problem. The one example that George Gilder uses is in the whole area of the FDA. Everything now, in terms of approval by the Federal Drug Administration, is based on whether or not it will give us a thalidomide situation again. Gilder and other economists' response to that is, those regulations need not be that strong. That we need to have people who are out there on the cutting edge of new dreams, new ideas, creating new supplies, and that if something comes up, then we will find people then to do the changing, do the correcting of what those ideas are doing to us. Economics are governed by thoughts. They reflect not the laws of matter, but the laws of the mind. And let me give you a quote. My wife doesn't like to hear me read, so I'll try and keep it short. Because economies are governed by thoughts, they reflect not the laws of matter, but the laws of the mind. One crucial law of mind is that belief precedes knowledge. New knowledge does not come without a leap of hypothesis, a projection by the intuitive sense. The logic of creativity is look, leap before you look. You cannot fully see anything new from an old place. The old saw of look before you leap provides only for the continual elaboration and refinements of old ideas that comprise the bulk of scholarship and the bulk of industrial progress in large and static companies. George Gilder also goes on to say, all creative thought is thus in a sense religious, initially a product of faith and belief. But not all ideas are true. Commitment is necessary, but not sufficient. His last chapter is Necessity for Faith. And that just threw me through the window. I've reread it now about 3 times, and I was not ready for him to bring up God talk. Very seriously, George Gilder feels that God gives us the creativity to bridge out into new areas. Supply side. Create things that are new. And in the midst of that, we need to reduce the kind of regulations that government have. We need to reduce taxes so that we can free up investment capital. And we need to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to do work and use their time productively. Thus his cutbacks in social service programs and the Reagan administration's approval of retirement now at 70. So that time is not used for leisure. That's about 20 minutes in, and I'm willing to start answering some questions now. What is work?
Like for the job that you and I have does not produce anything. Do we in fact work in this?
It depends on which chapter you're looking at, because sometimes he really downplays those people who offer services. The supply side has a difficult time dealing with a country which moves increasingly towards service and not production. But some services are essential. He did not specifically talk about ministers. He talked about lawyers, dentists, doctors, social workers, psychologists, the whole office syndrome. One of those that was not included was us. Teachers were part of that, especially college education and the proliferation of colleges. That it's increased the number of people involved in service industry, but it has not shown an equal increase in terms of the gross national product.
De-emphasized. I thought it was very interesting that you just said that they said that the cutting edge is ideas, but the people who deal with ideas should be cutting.
That's what they do with research.
Did we say the cutting edge was ideas? That's the growing edge. That's where creativity comes and so on. But the people who deal with ideas, they're expendable. That's a rather unique conundrum, it seems to me.
I don't think you really said they're expendable.
Not expendable, but they ought to be reduced. They ought to be involved in other kinds of areas. I get the impression that he really believes that education ought to be limited, that we have gone too far in terms of credentialing people for particular jobs, that we do not necessarily rely on a person's intuitive sense to be able to work, so that now the entry level is now a high school diploma for anything. And then beyond that, some community college training, and in college. And what we have done is over-credential people, because we have a lot of PhDs in certain fields who are walking the streets with no job and no possibility of job in their chosen field.
What about under-credentialed people?
He feels that the credentialing mode of this nation has really done harm to those people who are under-credentialed. There are some ways in which corporations, when they interview on a college campus, don't necessarily want to know whether a person is a straight-A student in business to go to work for Procter & Gamble. But they do want to know how well you learn, how adaptable you are, how willing you are to go in and do the learning in their system. And if you show that you are a good student, a learning person, then the corporations want you. And that style used to be a part of even positions below high school level. If a person came in and said, I'm willing to work, I want to work, I will show up on time, I will come every day, then companies were willing to take a risk on people because they showed initiative. But with the kind of regulations, again from George Gilder's perspective, that the government has put on equal employment opportunities, discrimination on sex, race, and other reasons, companies have become much more leery of hiring people who are uncredentialed. And so thus they have focused in on what are the realizable credentials. If you've got a high school diploma, that says you ought to be able to do X amount of work. It has nothing to do with the individual's drive internally. Chuck.
My reaction is not a meeting one, it's a long-held one, that supply-side economics is grossly immoral for more than one reason. It's grossly immoral in the sense that the market, a free, uncontrolled, unregulated market,
regulates the economy. I think that's just bad business. It may not be good business, but it's bad in terms of the society and meeting social needs. I think the economy ought to be regulated. We should not be slaves of the economy. The economy should be slaves of a controlling system. That's one thing. And then the necessity of this free expansion and growth. You know, the world can't do it. I mean, the world can't bear it. All that growth essential is part of an expanding market, more goods, I don't think the world can handle it. And what really makes a system like that grossly immoral is when it receives a religious dimension. You know, that bombs out the whole thing.
How does it relate to international economics? Supply-siders, are really thinking in terms of just the United States. How does it relate to the international situation?
He really doesn't say much about it.
Well, relates to what our friend O'Hara says, because it seems to be bordered. And in that respect, it doesn't fit well, and it doesn't appear to fit well within the true world situation. It's an observation, maybe that's not right, but it seems that way.
George Gilder makes the one observation that the auto industry in particular has to deal with not only the competition from overseas and then by companies which are then subsidized by the government, and that if we reduce the regulations, and he lists a considerable number, going from auto emissions to air safety bags that ought to be reduced, taken out. He makes a quote that somewhere in the cost of a car is about $200 worth of government regulations that they ought to be removed.
You know how the auto industry solved creatively the emission problem in my Plymouth? The emission regulations are measured at the tailpipe, where it comes out the exhaust. My car has a neat little pump that pumps fresh air into the exhaust right as it comes out of the manifold, so that all it does is dilute the pollution before it gets to the measuring point. It does nothing to reduce the pollutant.
Well, the one thing he says is that in terms of that's true. I'm not going to disagree with it. Is that the auto industry chose at one point not to be creative in terms of looking at the coming auto emissions, and that their way of solving the emission problem was going to the catalytic converter. But it was Honda who came up with a new engine which didn't need it. And I think one of the consistent things that he talks about that I've experienced in terms of looking at especially the whole electronics field and computers now is that that's a venture industry. Major corporations do not create new ideas. Individuals create new ideas, and they're either on their own to develop that idea, or their idea is then bought by a major corporation. And you know that kind of puts a hole in the Ford's little light bulb and General Electric slogan and some other things, but consistently history has shown that most new ideas either come from outside the corporation or from spin-offs of engineers and developers who are tired of the corporate model and spin off themselves and then buy back into the corporation with an idea.
The tightened regulations one more time, and then Honda threw out the new engine. They have three valve, two combustion chamber engine, 79 and 80. They threw it out. They're back to two valves and they have a catalytic converter.
Yeah.
Chuck, you want a more controlled economy? Don't you think people are smart enough to figure out on their own what they want without having the government tell them?
When a dollar is the measure, and when creating demands is essential, I think nothing is sacred. Nothing is sacred. Rivers, streams, air, nothing. And to imply that technology will come along with an answer to the new problem, we're getting near the end of technology and science's ability to solve problems.
Not true at all.
Oh, yes.
Not true at all.
Oh, no. The problem with technology is not that it can't solve a problem, but that there's a diminishing cost effectiveness in solving the problems. That to solve the problem costs far more than to solve the problem. And so you just won't solve the problem. And the chemists at Capital, and they're no dumber than chemists anyplace else. They've been trained at Harvard and wherever you want to go. The chemists and the physicists are saying we cannot solve the problems because, you know, every new solution creates another problem, and the problems are increasing, and the problem becomes increasingly more and more expensive. And so the economy cannot support the technical solutions that are necessary in, well, I think in unregulated...
I think you're way off base there, too. We don't know what the future holds. Look what's happened in 5 years in computers. You know, an IBM computer had to be this big 5 years ago. And today you got an Apple computer, which will match it. Nobody dreamed this would be impossible.
But to say that technology will solve the problems, someone who says that is not the parent of the thalidomide baby.
Nothing's perfect. And I'm a physician, and, you know, it's a terrible chore for me to keep up on the new medicine that's coming out, the calcium blockers. I think technology is our answer, because technology is going to help us solve these problems that are coming up in the future.
In the early 1900s, they almost closed the patent office.
That's right.
Because they thought everything had been invented already.
Thomas Alva Edison also said that he thought his era had just about completed the era of inventions. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the longbow at one point was the ultimate fighting weapon. You could get off 5 shots in 1 minute.
But it was never supposed to be another war when the machine gun came along, because it's such a horrible weapon.
I think the medical profession is one of the prime examples of the need for regulation. When you think in terms of human experimentation and all those new products and the ethics in the medical trade of not using human beings as guinea pigs for things, you know, that's a big issue.
I think you're way off base there, too, because my wife is reading a book, and I can't remember the name of it, but and I read a couple chapters on it, and it's when the immigrants came across the plains. And it's these women's diaries. And literally thousands of children died during those trips. Scarlet fever. You see anybody with scarlet fever lately?
No, that's not the point. You talk about all these new things that are coming out. And supply-side economics would say, throw them on the market. If it kills a few million people, we'll figure out another way to save them.
No, I don't think they're saying that at all.
That's what it's saying.
They're saying people have to be ethical. And you have to have faith in the people. You know, I'm not going to take your appendix out just because I'm going to make $500 doing it.
And government provides the ethics.
Baloney. Government only impedes. For instance, let me give an example. You heard of a CAT scanner?
Sure.
Okay, I serve on the governor's certificate of need panel in Nebraska. And all of a sudden the government said that the CAT scanners were not needed. So this is new technology. They spent literally millions of dollars blocking CAT scanners. A hospital in Washington, D.C. couldn't get a CAT scanner because they blocked it. A patient was admitted there, had a cerebral aneurysm, and died. The hospital was sued because they didn't have a CAT scanner. And the patient won. How ludicrous. The government on one hand says you can't have a CAT scanner. On the other hand, the patient gets sued because they don't have one. I mean, I spend 15 hours a week filling out, you know, paperwork. The regulations are onerous.
Yeah, but if CAT scanners were put on the market without regulation, every hospital would have one.
CAT scanners are not being regulated now. The government has removed all the regulations.
Yeah, but not every city has 6. There's usually some kind of local, agreed-upon kind of control. But if all the hospitals had CAT scanners, our medical costs would be 50 times what they are now.
No, I don't agree with that.
That's obvious.
If it wasn't so regulated,
also,
somebody
covered by Medicare.
CAT scanners, yeah, they're covered by Medicare. You know, I think you have to depend on the ethics of the people who are... sure, there's a few charlatans in every field, but I think by and large, most people in most of these fields are responsible people.
I guess I'm concerned when the bottom line is the dollar and nothing else.
That's
what supply-side economics is all about, is making a profit.
Well, not necessarily. That's not necessarily true. George Gilder said a couple of things which it's going to indict your profession.
That's right.
which kind of surprised me because
Gilder walks a strange kind of picket fence. And there are times when I really want to go and say, this guy is really a lunatic. And I'm going, but I kind of agree with what he's got to say. One of the places in which the entrepreneurial spirit no longer exists is in the legal profession and in the medical profession. And those two professions generally have higher salaries than politicians or the average middle-class working man. Doctors are especially onerous in terms of supply side because they invest in non-speculative items. Doctors tend to put their money in gold, land, collectibles, whether they're plates, stamps, coins, etc., art. They do not invest in venture capital items. As a general profession, he said that, and I kind of went, whoops. The legal profession is essentially in that same ballpark. And so there's some way of looking at that. Chuck, I think you're right on the money. You probably say it a little harder than he wants it said. But essentially, supply-side economics says that technology will catch up to our mistakes and that there will be mistakes made. Essentially, what he is trying to say is that there are times when Thomas Alva Edison could have blown up half of his neighborhood in doing some of his experiments, but he didn't. He somehow survived, his neighbors somehow survived, and he had somehow the ability to pull together electrons in a way in which we could have light. And what Gilder is saying, we still need to have that entrepreneurial spirit who is not guided by those same kinds of regulations that now inhibit people from doing that kind of experimentation. I'm not sure he wants to be as cold and calloused as you make it sound. But I really have a feeling that somewhere along the line he was saying that if a drug is developed that somehow hurts some people, we'll take it off the market and find out why it hurts people and then correct it.
Well, you had a perfect example of that last week when
Eli Lilly just took a drug off.
Yeah, Oriflex was introduced, but, you know, and then it was withdrawn. So that proves to me that the regulatory system does, part of it does work, you know.
But give people the freedom and the choice to decide for themselves what they think will work. People decided they wanted Laetrile, so they go to Mexico for it.
That's right.
Now, it's perhaps being proven that it's worthless, but give them that freedom if that's what they want.
Then let them, let them choose adultery. Let them do whatever they want to. You know, we don't care. We say that about economics, but we don't want to say that about other things. And there's no difference.
And he will make the distinct difference.
Huh?
He makes some distinct differences. Because it is not just a free system, it's a free enterprise system. And he has some images of family life, family structure, the role of the man. Excuse me, ladies, I'm sorry, he did it to you. And especially white women. He really does a number on you. Black women he kind of raises a little bit because they have this problem in the black community of a matriarchal structure. And I still have some problems with that sociological model. I'm not sure that I buy into that all the time. But especially as it revolves around not so much middle class folks, but around welfare folks. And Gilder does some real hard nose talking about cutting at social services. Because that's one of the things that taxes us. And it also talks about giving those people the opportunity to work and almost forcing them to work. Unfortunately, Gilder then plays upon, I think, one of the items that concerns us all, and that's the whole issue of fraud, whether it's in Social Security, welfare, whatever it is. But he plays on it, and he plays on it hard. He does not talk about the success stories of the people who get off and stay off. He mentions it in passing. The one thing that really got to me is he talked about black entrepreneurs from the 20s and the 30s, and he probably picked the worst example that I could have ever heard of, and that's Father Divine. I was flabbergasted.
Who was Father Divine?
Father Divine was a religious preacher radio star, authority, he encouraged blacks to literally lift themselves up by their bootstraps. They started businesses, with a lot of the profits going to the church, cleaners, restaurants. He even had an employment agency in New York which hired out domestics for people's homes, nursery people. It was a major enterprise, especially in the East. And then Father Divine did the unthinkable. He absconded with the church's funds. You know, the combination of both those in one image was really noxious for me. But essentially he is saying that people need to work. Their time needs to be productive. Welfare is leisure time. I'd like to have him live in a welfare home as a welfare mother a couple of times with some folks I know.
Yeah, how does he handle, like, take the city of Detroit that built a full creative kind of an industry and a massive workforce. That's what he's talking about, people who work, all right? That massive workforce in the city of Michigan, I mean in the state of Michigan, a lot of them in the state of Ohio, that are automotive dependent, are all of a sudden not a lot of work. Whose fault? It's not theirs. It's the failure somehow of the
industry.
It's
the failure.
Who takes care of it?
Well, no. He says it's the failure, not so much of the industry, because we cannot expect the industry to continue to be the new thinker. It's the failure to supply venture capital for new people to have new ideas to hire those people into new jobs. I'm not saying I agree with him, but that's what he says.
Stu, what would be his response to an economic system that is increasingly moving toward mergers and conglomerates instead of reinvesting money in the new? Does he propose that you break that up so that it can be more creative? Or, it seems to me he would have difficulty with that argument. I mean, you know, what is actually happening, and it seems to me the claim that the government is trying to create, it fosters that kind of movement toward non-creative investment.
Yeah.
And then I think the major thing that problem I have is in this whole system about let people buy whatever they want, you know, it simply is unjust for 6% of the world's population to consume 30 to 60% of its materials. I mean, that system is not working for most of God's people.
Hang on to all the parts of that and see if I can get to all of them, Charlie, because you raised about three or four different issues in there. Let's take the corporate gulping of other companies first. Because of the way in which our economy has gone right now, people are afraid to do investing. And the biggest fear lies in those who have money. The wealthy class in this country are some of our poorest investors. They are taking a beating in terms of taxes, so they end up being consumers. They buy large cars, they buy vacations all over the world, they buy yachts. And so then they eat up part of that capital that way, rather than investing it. And he has little regard for people who are especially wealthy, who do spend inordinate amounts of money. And he says that some people have predicted that we will be buying yachts up until the day our economy dies, because there are people in that classification. He talks about a few, though, who then make some breaks with that system. One is the guy who then won or somehow inherited $400,000. I can't remember his name, but it's from New Hampshire, and he then became the president of National Semiconductor. He has parlayed that into rescuing. He took his $400,000 and decided he wanted to rescue bankrupt companies, which is really a venture, a risky business. It's doomed to failure. But that's what the entrepreneur is. He's a gambler. And he tries to play off that 1% or that 10% area of winning. In the process, he has saved four different companies and made them all profitable. including rescuing the Aston Martin Company in Britain. At the same time, John DeLorean was being wooed by the British government to start the DeLorean Automobile Company in Ireland. The Aston Martin is doing great sales in Europe. It is not being sold in this country, primarily because of the auto standards for cars being imported. And so he doesn't import them into this country, but they're doing fine everywhere else. DeLorean is losing money and sitting still. That's one image of a person who had wealth who was then willing to risk it. But
that's
generally,
a good illustration of people with money buying those, because my dad had a friend that had a brake job done on Aston Martin, about $1,000.
You understand what he's doing. The same thing applies to major corporations. Because of the tax structure, it is not profitable for them to invest money in research and development. It is more profitable to take their profits and buy up losses of other corporations or to buy other corporations as investments. In other words, they're investing not unlike wealthy people in collectibles. They are making a dollar and getting out as quick as they can. Or they make money off a factory until it no longer is profitable, and before it takes a loss, they close it. That is how he views major corporations and multinationals. And I really wasn't clear because he did talk about John Kenneth Galbraith's two-tiered model of economic theory, that there are the multinationals on one level who also work with government in setting policies, and then there's the small entrepreneurs who, you know, manage an individual tool shop here or, you know, a manufacturing plant over here, but they're kind of smaller businesses in relationship to the multinationals. I didn't quite understand his dialogue about that, except that he didn't like Galbraith's model, but he just thought that somehow they were not into the major corporations and multinationals were not in the supply side. Now that's part one of yours. What was the other part?
How the marketplace is going to regulate situation, regulate itself in a time of increasing scarcity. The thing that I keep puzzling over is how the classic definition of inflation is too many dollars chasing too few goods, and we're going to have increasingly fewer goods in terms of raw materials because they're going to become increasingly scarce. How are you going to increase production without creating inflation? I don't understand.
Because human creativity has lots of room to expand.
But we have a finite resource. I mean,
an infinite creativity. And
that's the answer that system provides.
Let me give you a very quick image of what he says in one particular area, Charlie, and that's in the area of energy. He feels that our creativity has not done a good job of exploring the resources of the world. That in the world all over, all the rest of the world in terms of exploration for petroleum products, crude oil, the United States has been probably the most explored area, and the rest of the world in terms of cumulative average investing in investment of where those resources are have only done 10% of what has happened in the United States. And so that there's got to be more out there that we don't know about. Now that's Gilder's response to energy as only one part of that cycle you're talking about. Tomorrow we do some alternatives.